Julie's given us the overview from the Gloucestershire Archives about it. Jeff Hogg along something. Now, Jeff, you never worked at Fielding & Platt, did you?
No, never. I didn't arrive in Gloucester till 1990, by which time most of Fielding & Platt's work had been transferred to other companies or the company that brought them out. And obviously, shortly after that, the buildings were pulled down. The area now forms part of the Gloucester Keys. But having an engineering background, I found it very interesting going through the order books. The main one I'm working on at the moment, transcribing from the actual order book onto a spreadsheet, which will eventually go onto the website, covers the 1883 to 1887. And some of the orders are extremely interesting. Apart from exporting all over the world, places like Japan, New Zealand, Russia, the Ottoman government in Constantinople, there is some interesting little snippets come out. One in particular is an order dated 22nd of February 1887 for a Mr. James Rosser of Colford purchasing an 8-horsepower engine with a winding drum. The total cost was £135. He purchased this on a hire purchase agreement, paying £1.10 in old money. Or £1.50 in today's money. And he was going to pay this in either coal or cash, which was most convenient to Mr. Rosser, with the coal priced at 3 shillings 5 pence, or 17.5 pence, per tonne, which meant if he was paying the full £1.50, he would have to supply approximately 10 tonnes of coal per week to Fielding & Platt. I'd imagine that quite a number of their machinery at that time was steam-powered, so therefore the coal would obviously go into Fielding & Platt boilers to provide the steam.
You think back, you know, when these were being made, these orders were being placed, the guys who did the administration of these orders had no idea that you, Jeff Hogg, was going to be looking at these in 2015 and picking through what they'd done.
No, exactly. The first order in this book is dated 1883, which is 152 years ago, which actually coincides. It was the same year my grandfather was born, which can give you an idea of how far back it was.
But, I mean, the range of goods that they delivered must be available in all these orders as well.
Oh, yes. Some of the orders are very highly descriptive with the specification of exactly what the customer wanted. The main ones are the ones to the Admiralty. One order can cover 4 or 5 pages with a complete detailed specification. And then towards the end of the orders on some of them, they actually give you the delivery details, even to the fact that one particular order was going to the Royal Albert Docks in London to be loaded upon a steamship, the Moorhen, that was going out to Japan to take riveting equipment for torpedo cases.
I mean, the range goes on. I mean, there were other factories close by, wasn't there? I mean, there was the Wagon Works just out the back. Did they supply there as well?
Yes, they supplied the Gloucester Carriage and Wagon Works, as it was called in those days. There were some other smaller companies within Gloucester itself, small engineering companies, some railway companies that would have had track into and from Gloucester, and the fact that most of the goods, though, from Fielding's was shipped out by rail to various ports throughout the country, like London, Liverpool, Humberside.
Looking at your notes, I'm cribbing over your shoulder here. I can see vacuum cleaners, Italy, Società Metallurgica Italiana, all these places, they were worldwide, weren't they?
They
were. Mentioned Japan already.
Yes, they were, absolutely. And America. They obviously had an agent in America, the Morgan Engineering Company, which placed orders on Fielding & Platt for other engineering and shipbuilding companies within America. And some of the details of the addresses they were going to, there's one that went to the foot of East 11th Street, New York City, New York.
That's pretty precise as to where to go, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, it was.
Now, I mean, how many of these order books are there? I mean, are there loads and loads and loads? Are they sort of annual books or whatever?
Oh, no. This one particular book that I'm working on at present covers a period of 5 years. There's almost 600 pages in this book, and most of the orders do have either filled in Platt's internal order number, or there was obviously they had a representative who went round to companies discussing what they wanted, and he also had an order book, and there are references to his actual individual orders. And so far, John Bancroft has produced a list of order books that appear to be in the archives, which range from 1912 up to 1935.
And as a guy who doesn't come from round here, who didn't work at Fielding and Platt, this must be wonderful, because you are an engineer at heart, aren't you? To just to see all this and read about it must be phenomenal for you.
Well, yes, because actually my first job when I left school was as a trainee draftsman in an engineering company that manufactured large commercial catering equipment. So going from the drawing office down to the workshop, seeing the guys actually making these items, I can have got a good appreciation of the chaps that worked at Fielding's, having drawings or detailed specifications coming from the drawing office, and oh yes, this is what we've got to make, and getting the materials and actually making it.
But Jeff, you've also been looking at the wage books as well, haven't you?
Yes, two wage books I've transcribed across cover the period of July 1900 to July 1915. It only covers office staff, which was the drawing office, general office, foreman and timekeepers, and one sales rep who was based in London. Now, the wages starting off, the earliest one I have is for a Mr. Greenhill in July 1900, was earning 4 shillings a week. That's 20 pence in modern day language. And he went through right until 1908. He went from general office to foreman, back to general office, and his wages in 1908 were 55 shillings or £2.75 a week. For a normal 44-hour week.
You're going to say 44-hour a week it would have been in those days, yeah.
Yes, which was probably Monday to Friday and Saturday morning. One interesting item with the wages books is between September 1914 and July 1915, following the start of the First World War, the number of men in the drawing office and general office gradually decreased, and the number of unmarried women increased, possibly due to the men being either joining up or being called up for the First World War. Also, interestingly, in July 1912, the National Insurance Act 1911 came into force, which meant every employee earning less than £160 a year had a graduated deduction from their wages between a penny and fourpence old money, depending on their actual wage. Employer paid 3 pence per employee, and 2 pence was paid in by the state. This was to cover small payments for sickness and short-term unemployment.
Imagine what that did to the company, though. You know, that company then had to start paying 3 pence a week per employee. They hadn't paid before, and in those days, 3 pence per employee per week would end up at the end of the year as a significant amount.
It would do, yes. And that is actually shown in the wages book. It's strange. By each employee's name, the amount is in red ink instead of the blue ink for the normal.
I'm sure it wasn't them having to pay that back.
Oh, no.
Now, I talked to Julie and her colleagues a while ago, and one of the interesting things from all the books that they got out from me was the handwriting. And when the clerk changed, you could see the change of handwriting from parish records, etc., etc. I'll bet you've got original handwriting in all of these. This isn't typed, is it?
Oh, no. All these books are handwritten with pen and ink, probably an ordinary, what we used to call at school, scratchy pen.
Yeah,
with a nib.
With a nib.
Nib. And you
more
can,
over your fingers than over the page.
That's it. And on the books, you can see ink splodges on the pages and on the edge of the pages. And it does. You can soon tell when the person writing the order book has changed. Some of them had quite fancy writing, which made it difficult to try and make out the name, especially when it was foreign companies. if it's an English name, you can often see it.
You probably know the place and you just fill in the letters you can't do and get it automatically. But if you're talking about Italy, you probably wouldn't.
Wouldn't, no, no. And some of the names of the people or names of the company, as you said earlier about the Metallurgica, and there is another one here, which I don't know if Pete can actually...
Compagnie de Cheminées de Fer de Madrid de Saragossa et Alicante for Committee de Paris. Nobody knows whether that's right or wrong because nobody can see it.
No, no. And sometimes you have to look for common words that you know to see whether it's an A, an E, an F, an L, by actually comparing that with, say, a known word, a word you
But you think back to the times these were handwritten like this, and this is beautiful, joined up writing with a pen with a nib, dipping it in the ink. All the other companies around Gloucestershire that were doing this, and they had their clerks doing the same thing. The amount of this material and the books themselves, there were thousands and thousands. This was going on as a daily basis. But looking at this, does it fascinate you, looking at the writing and thinking the person behind it?
Yes, it does, because of the way you see them on the capital letters are starting to be, as you would might see in an old medieval document, slightly...
They're a bit more elaborate, aren't they?
Elaborate, and when they do a capital Q, it looks more like a 2. And again, it's because you know the word, and you look at the end there, that's an R. Angular, you know how to spell it,
yeah.
And you know that's an R, but a quick look, you'd think...
It looks a bit like shorthand.
Shorthand, yes, yes. Of course, the thing is, in this day, everything was in old imperial measurement. So nowadays, where we use millimetres, centimetres... You have inches and parts of an inch, like 1 1/8 inch. Mm. There is one that wanted something 1 9/16 yeah. inch in diameter. And you're thinking, how would somebody nowadays convert that into metric? What would that be?
Well, you're right. How much more of this have you got to do, Jeff? How much is there left to evaluate?
Oh, I would probably see my 100th birthday if I was still doing it. At least a couple of years. This particular order book I'm working on has almost 600 pages to it, and I have about just over 100 pages left to transcribe in this book. And there are probably another 7 or 8 order books to go through.
So all I can say is if you're listening to this and you happen to have lying about your house, how you got it, I don't know, a Fielding & Platt order book, a Fielding & Platt wages book, or you know where they are, we would love to hear it because we want to keep this man going beyond his 100th birthday if you can.